back to the Ruthie Gilmore definition of racism, right? That is not just something that attaches itself to a body. So, for example, President Obama, have you seen him cry recently? He cried in Newton, no cries, no tears here. What's the presidential executive response? Well, a couple of things. You can order a Department of Justice civil rights inquiry, which he does. But if you understand, once again, the chessboard, in the DOJ, which is the place you go to prosecute civil rights infractions, the civil rights division is a weaker division than the prosecutorial arm. The DOJ has a weird remit. It's both the chief law enforcement officer of the land, meaning the police and the welfare of the police come under the DOJ, and it's also the civil rights division. So when the first black woman attorney general takes office, what's her maiden speech? Does anyone remember? I feel very concerned about the morale of police in the country right now. Why does she say that? Because she is playing her role as the number one law enforcement officer of the land, right? So can I just leave it at that? It's such a big, complicated topic, but I do not think that the rules necessitate that the bodies that execute these systemic tendencies have to be white, okay? Yeah, right. It's weaker on a number of different regards. It's weaker because it's been systematically made weaker through funding policies and things of that nature. But it's also made weaker through this social political priority that is given towards law enforcement that we see repeated. So, for example, on the one hand, you remember when Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman, and President Obama did make a speech at that point. I guess it got too frequent. He doesn't make speeches for each case anymore. But, you know, in that instance, you know, he made that speech and he said, you know, Trayvon Martin could have been my son, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to, launch a federal civil rights investigation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the Obama administration has repeatedly, in Supreme Court cases dealing with police violence, inordinately and overwhelmingly supported briefs in support of the police. No, he's not lying. He's in charge of both arms. He's launching the federal DOJ investigation for civil rights, and he's also backing the police with this crappy information. Okay. I mean, if I had a blueprint, you should be incredibly suspicious of me. I think this is something we have to collectively work out. Right, I know to read the signs as an anthropologist, people see the attacks on the cars, police cars and police in North Carolina as being irrational and social disorder. As an anthropologist, I'll tell you quite otherwise. It's very rational. It's very rational. It's rational political action that they are taking. I have a close friend, William Kaplan, who does the liberal thing. He's not liberal, but he does his best in trying to stem down police violence in Philadelphia. He actually runs police awareness workshops. And his sister, he comes from a working class background, his sister is also a Philadelphia police officer. But when we were talking about this, like, what do you think, you know, will actually get them to cool down? And we looked at each other, and this is when the recent shootings of police had occurred. And we both knew the answer was when police get killed. They cool down momentarily. And he was not saying this lightly because his sister is also in the police department, right? But if you want to look at evidence-based, I'm not saying it's a long-lasting effect, but we are up against very difficult structural issues. There's no easy answer. If I say go riot, actually you can also look at the second and third, fourth acts after riot, and then think about whether this is a legitimate strategy or not. Because there's no inherent goodness to rioting or not rioting, and I want to be clear about that, rioting or not rioting. If you study history, you know, Tulane's diversity initiative, when did this start going on? Since the Mizzou uprisings last November. Then I'm in like a faculty of color retreat with the president, and I'm like in this and I'm that and this. You know, it's just like, oh, I'm getting invitations left, right, and center for 5 years. You know, there was nothing. What do you want to surmise from that? But I think it's something that needs to be collectively worked out. Now, as scholars, it's far and through scholarly methodology and scholarly intervention, right? I would propose there are certain lines that you can attempt, experiments that you can attempt along these areas that we have suggested as being ripe for intervention within the field of critique, right? And the field of opening up areas of research. That's not a panacea, that's not a silver bullet, but there's no silver bullet to something that's as pervasive. So I would say that you would be having to do multiple things, you know, as well as looking at history to understand what has actually made significance and what has not. The final thing that I would say is that if you think back to the 1960s, I don't know if anybody knows, you know, this book, We Charge Genocide, or this report. William Patterson, the African-American leader, and a group around him had actually collected systemic data on racial violence against African-Americans and the broader conditions of life chances of African-Americans in 1960s United States, and submitted a report to the United Nations saying we charge genocide. And from there has emerged a tradition of understanding that the laws and frameworks, juridical frameworks of the United States are actually incapable of solving the racism against African-Americans, right? It's incapable of solving the race of the chessboard. It's incapable of solving the racism against African-Americans. And so people turn to other kinds of frameworks, human rights, the United Nations, international. Now, of course, the U.S. is the largest power in the world and doesn't even pay UN fees, refuses to pay UN fees. So is there any greater power to the U.S. right now in Machiavellian terms? And the answer is no. But people have also moved in this direction, right, to recognize that what is happening, incremental measures of oppression which are expected. You and I all know, think of the scandal of this. You and I all know by tomorrow, day after, next week, there's going to be another black person killed in our country. And you and I know that we are not going to be able to do anything to stop that. We know in advance there will be premature deaths of black people. And yet, we can live good lives, fall in love, get married, raise kids, whatever, in the knowledge that this incremental, expected, routine, justified killings of black people will continue. So it comes under what Nancy Shepherd Hughes will call a genocide continuum, not just one in terms of an immediate sensational event, but something that is far more prolonged, that results in the ongoing endangerment and prematurely terminated lives of black people. And these are people I encourage you to read, but the work of João Costa Vargas, you know, and I will conclude here, is that when we think about genocidal dynamics, we all know it wasn't just Hitler doing something that caused the genocide to take place. The entire German nation went along with it. So what is genocide then? You have the quote there from Costa Vargas. All right, I'll stop there. It's not, you know, it's not his attitude. If you put any one of you here, any black person here or me in that position, you'd have to play by the rules, unless there's a revolutionary president, you know, out to take down the American system and runs on that basis. You know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is not going to matter very much to the rules. And I didn't have time to elaborate, but for example, you know, there are some things that President Obama accepts as rules. It's not that he cannot challenge it. He could even challenge it rhetorically, but he does not. But there are rules that he plays by. One is whenever there is an incident of police abuse or violence, let alone killings, right? He goes by the doctrine that happened after the defeat of Reconstruction in American history, which is that policing is a what matter? State matter. And the federal government, which he is in charge of, should not interfere with the state. He follows that doctrine. He's following the chessboard. I never said Obama was not a really good player of the chessboard. He's excellent. He's brilliant. He's wonderful. He's spectacularly talented in ways that, you know, we didn't anticipate. At least nobody I knew who ran numbers anticipated his victory. But he plays very much within those rules. And those rules, though, do not mitigate against the violence, the structural violence that are going to be faced by African Americans and all the public health ramifications. We can think about that, right? So Yeah, the president agrees to the division between federal and state jurisdictions with the state with this. He agrees to put forward the most robust defense of police in cases of police killings of black people towards the Supreme Court, right? He instructs his top lawyers to do that, as well as he does the instruction for civil rights infractions and investigations. He adjudicates both of them. And this is why when I go back to my definition of routine anti-racist failure, so if you look at this process as being a liberal process that's supposed to stand above and remediate racism, and what I will tell you is that in the chessboard, your chances of getting racial justice will be a routine failure. And to understand why civil rights jurisdiction and enforcement is very weak, you have to study the history of the 14th Amendment jurisprudence that has taken place, which is a whole course taught by Professor Robert Wesley in the law school. I cannot get into that right now, but just to make a very simple point, over history, there's been successive case law, 14th Amendment, does everyone know what 14th Amendment is? It's not the freeing of slaves, that was 13th. The 14th Amendment, after the freeing of slaves, what the United States Reconstruction Congress found out was African Americans were still being enslaved and still being subject to racial violence despite the 13th Amendment. So they have to come up with the 14th Amendment to outlaw discrimination, okay? And the Congress at that time felt it necessary not only to free the slaves, but also enact an amendment that will protect the ex-slave from discrimination. And that is the basis. Every discrimination case, whether it's homophobia, anti-Asian racism, anti-Muslim racism, all of that derives from the tradition of 14th Amendment jurisprudence, right? But over the years, case law has made 14th Amendment jurisprudence and claims weaker in relation to other constitutionally guaranteed liberties, which are habitually enjoyed. For example, if you want to desegregate a school, if it clashes with the right of whites to have freedom of association to be with whoever the hell they want to be with, 14th Amendment in successive case law, which requires you to stop the discrimination, is weaker than the constitutional need to uphold the right of people to have freedom of association with whoever the hell they want. And we've had 100 plus years of the weakening of the 14th Amendment. So when you have the president and then the attorney general and then civil rights division and the DOJ, then that's what I mean when the civil rights is structurally weaker. I mean, the two ways you can go. One, you can look at it as, you know, it's a prejudice of the particular person or a white fragility of the particular person. Like in the Terrence Crutcher case, a white woman, despite the fact that Crutcher had been tasered, still felt herself, threatened and pumped some bullets into this guy and killed him, right? Or Keith Lamont yesterday, who's sitting in a car reading a book, waiting for his son, and a book is a gun, and they killed him. The perception, though, was it reasonable? Oh, black guy holding something in a car, you know, the perception is out of reasonable, so okay, right? So the thing is, if we look at it from prejudice, which is one way to think about fear, I think we are very handicapped, right? But let's think about this other notion. The police officer, whether white or black, is charged to what? Serve and protect. But what? Property. I had a police, I did my research in the UK, and when I kept coming up with, you know, all my cases I would take up of this were racial hate crimes and attacks, and I spoke to this police commissioner. I was like, why is it, you know, why don't you investigate these things? You know, like, you know, why, like, and this person was minority police officer. So, you know, I was a little bit emotional. And he got emotional back at me. And he says, like, why don't we investigate these things? Well, what the hell are we judged on? And he said the parameters for how they are judged upon, number one, you know, theft of property. Those are the indicators by which you're judged upon. Who owns property that you want to steal, right? You remember the case of that Indian grandfather in Alabama? The Indian grandfather is visiting, doesn't know English, from India. He's walking down this all-white suburb. The white residents of the suburb, you know, a couple calls. There's a skinny black guy, you know. He sees this Indian man as a skinny black guy walking down the pavement. Now, I always talk about this case because it illustrates so many things. The pavement, is that private property? Can anybody walk on it? So why do you call the police? Because why? Why? Why do you call the police? Because what do you think that pavement is? my private property in my neighborhood. Do the police structurally agree with this presumption? Yes. Do they come to act to serve and protect the property owner who feels threatened? Yes. And delivers a militarized tackle that leaves this Indian grandfather paralyzed from neck down. Okay? So the notions of property is quite fluid. It doesn't even have to be your actual house or actual thing. It can be your neighborhood, who's supposed to be in there, who's not supposed to be in there. And whether you're a black or white police officer, you are structurally oriented towards functioning the role of serving and protecting property, which already, of course, carries an implicit class and racial structural bias. No, and I think this goes beyond prejudice. This goes beyond like some cracker or some KKK guy like going like, you know, whatever, right? If you are like, let's say, my dad, your dad, who's called to be the police officer in that situation. Now, his structural performance is based on delivering safety to the white couple that has just called about the skinny white guy walking on a public pavement that is actually their neighborhood, which ought to mean that non-white people are not there,